Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, June 26th, 2003. Today's session is entitled Jesus, Defenseless People, Politics, and Power, Session 4 of Every Church a Peace Church, presented by John K. Stoner, number STJ-2003-03. Let's listen in.
Start that tape. So this is another session on Every Church a Peace Church. I'm John Stoner from Akron, Pennsylvania. I work as coordinator of Every Church a Peace Church. Our project is to stimulate a grassroots movement in the churches to rediscover and implement the nonviolent life and teachings of Jesus. We've looked at some of the church history implications, what the church has done with Jesus and his teachings, or not done with them, including Constantine and the compromises of the church with empire and imperial power down through the centuries. Today, I'd like you to join me in thinking about Jesus in relation to defenseless people and politics and power. Did Jesus face the hard questions which government leaders face when they have to do something on behalf of people who are threatened physically, perhaps, you know, their lives are in danger? So is Jesus engaged in these hard questions about people who may die if somebody doesn't intervene to help them? I think there seems to be a lot of thinking that people or Jesus in his time didn't have to deal with the Saddam Hussein kind of characters, you know, or the Hitler kind of questions. Those are tough questions that governments maybe have to face, but Jesus was a spiritual leader and a religious figure. And the salvation he brought was for heaven, the next world. And so he didn't help us much with those hard questions. That's a common view. I think we ought to test and question that view. And as we do this this morning, think of it for yourself and going back to your community and your local church. Think of it in terms of this is experimenting this morning again with bringing to bear interpretations of Jesus' life and teachings that come out of the peace church or the nonviolent struggle tradition. In other words, not all interpretations of Jesus are the same, and there are many interpretations of Jesus' life and teachings that people have never heard. One of the tasks of building a peace church is to help people to see what they haven't seen, to understand what they haven't understood in the gospel stories. So I invite you to comment now on the basic question, did the fate of any defenseless people depend on Jesus? And if so, who? What kind of threats did Jesus' community or the people around him face at that time? They lived in the Roman Empire. Okay, and was that a friendly scene? I guess we say no. What were some of the implications of that? How did that impact?
I think the Romans worshipped a variety of gods, and they brought those gods with them when they conquered, you know, areas, and kind of expected them to at least coexist alongside the gods the people were already worshipping. And for the Jews, of course, that was a real problem.
Okay, so there were problems of religious idolatry.
Yeah.
How about economics, making a living?
Well, the vast majority of the people were just extremely poor. Mm-hmm. And, and Jesus' family, chances are we're among those poor people. And his identification all the way through the Gospels with the poor and all the social conditions that they had to live with is a big issue, a big social issue that really reaches its head when Jesus is crucified. I mean, it's one of the reasons why.
Yeah, that's so true. Jesus' identification with the poor really put him at odds with those who held the power and the wealth, starting with the Roman, the foreign system itself. But then there was complicity among Jewish leaders with that Roman system, and we want to look at that a little more this morning. You know, I just thought you might want to get some Bibles. There are Bibles over here. I'm going to be going into some of the few. Yeah.
My understanding is that the persecution of Christians under the Romans was not continuous, that there were long breaks in the persecution. And during that period of time, the church nurtured and grew. And it was, as was pointed out yesterday, at the time of Constantine, there were more Christians in Rome than any other religion.
Yes. So you're talking, however, at a time, you're talking the church history, not sort of those years when Jesus, just to focus on the time when his public ministry was happening. If you go into the next decades and centuries, you have a mixture of kinds of responses of the Roman Empire. But trying now just to focus on the very specific time when Jesus did his public ministry. I'd like to go to Mark chapter 8. Just remind you of something we've mentioned before, that the central message of Jesus was the kingdom or the kingship of God is at hand. Very political term, we said. Kingship, reign, sovereignty. And on the face of it, that sovereignty constitutes a challenge to other kingships or sovereignties already in place in the territory where Jesus announces the sovereignty of God. Now, Mark 8, interesting expression and discussion Jesus is having with his disciples. Mark 8, 11, we might begin at verse 11. Pharisees came and began to argue with him, asking him for a sign from heaven. Test him. He sighed deeply in his spirit and said, "Why does this generation ask for a sign? Truly I tell you, no sign will be given to this generation." And he left them, and getting into the boat again, he went across the other side. Now, we mentioned yesterday that the same text or idea in a couple of the other Gospels, Jesus brings in the sign of Jonah and says that he said there'll be no sign given to you except the sign of Jonah. But however that may be, the question here is signs and what things mean, symbolic meanings. Now the disciples had forgotten to bring any bread, and they had only one loaf with them in the boat. I remind you that this is after Jesus' feeding of the, 5,000 and of the 4,000. And the symbolism of those feedings of 5,000 and 4,000 really seems to be a feeding of Gentiles and a feeding of Jewish people. So Jesus he supplied the needs of both the Gentile community and the Jewish community in those feedings. And he cautioned them, saying, "Watch out, beware of the yeast of the Pharisees and the yeast of Herod." They said to one another, "Is it because we have no bread?" And being aware of it, Jesus said to them, "Why are you talking about having no bread? Do you still not perceive or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Do you not have eyes? Do you have eyes and fail to see? Do you have ears and fail to hear? And do you not remember?" And then he tells them how well he had supplied their needs, that there had been so much left over. I want you to focus on what might he have meant by the yeast or the leaven of the first Pharisees and the yeast of Herod? In the power structures of that time, who were the Pharisees? What kind of power did they have? Who was Herod? What kind of power did he have? Let's talk about Pharisees.
Religious leaders.
And maybe we can go just a step further and ask, because I'm suggesting that's what's going on here with Jesus, is that he's talking about who are you looking to for leadership, and who do you think is going to provide what is needed for our people who are in need, for our threatened Jewish community. So if you think of the Pharisees, what was their program for saving the Jewish community, for delivering them from the threats they faced? Just what was their strategy? What comes to mind?
Keeping the law?
Compliance to the law. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Kind of isolationism.
Okay, isolationism. And keep the community pure, keep the law, separate from Rome. So this is a Pharisee's program. We're going to be pure and obedient, and God will bless us. Now Herod, the yeast of Herod. What was Herod's program for the people?
Well, it was a political program, and Herod was sort of a traitor in that sense, because he really worked for the Roman Empire.
Yeah, ethnically or religiously, who was he?
He was a Jew.
He was a Jew, yeah. But he worked for Rome. Okay, he represented Rome. Okay, all I want to take from this at this moment is that I believe that what Jesus is doing here, when he's talking about signs and about bread, he's talking about, where are you looking for leadership? Who are you expecting to supply? What is needed? And he says, beware the yeast of the Pharisees. Beware the yeast of Herod. And then he talks about his own stuff. You know, this is a debate. Who's got the good stuff? Who's got the right stuff here? And he says, didn't you notice what I did in terms of supplying need? Well, let's move on. I realize that's very sketchy, but it's important to name the Pharisees and Herod as religious leadership parties, entities. Now let's go to Mark 3, step back to Mark 3. It's a leadership and power scene again. Jesus, this is very early in the Gospel of Mark, but Jesus is already getting into this tension with the Pharisees as leaders of the Jews. And verse of chapter 2, 23 says, one Sabbath he was going through the grain fields, disciples began to pluck, and the Pharisees said, why are his disciples doing this on the Sabbath? So you have that conflict, and then you come to chapter 3, Jesus in the synagogue on the Sabbath. I'd like somebody to read 3, 1 to 6. So that's the story, the bit piece we're looking at. Who would read that? 3, 1 to 6.
Again, he entered the synagogue, and a man was there who had a withered hand. They watched him to see whether he would cure him on the Sabbath so that they might accuse him. And he said to the man who had the withered hand, come forward. Then he said to them, is it lawful to do good or to do harm on the Sabbath, to save life or to kill? But they were silent. He looked around at them with anger. He was grieved at their hardness of heart and said to the man, stretch out your hand. He stretched it out, and his hand was restored. The Pharisees went out and immediately conspired with the Herodians against him, how to destroy him.
Thank you. I'm going to pass out some reprint text here. It includes this text, but the Bibles will be helpful for some of the other texts that we may look at. In this encounter in the synagogue, Again, would somebody repeat or describe the obvious need which is present in this room? The folks need.
Withered hand.
A man with a withered hand.
Handicap, yeah.
Okay. Now, we often think of Jesus as the healer of individuals. And he is that, isn't he? However, have you ever paused to be perplexed about why? Not that Jesus did some miraculous healings, but how do you explain why he did so few? Huh? With the all power of heaven and earth at his command, power of God. So, I mean, the sheer injustice of that could boggle your mind. How do these lucky people get chosen? So, if we look at what's happening, we will often, I think probably always see, that the healing of an individual is part of something bigger that is happening, and it is symbolic of other things that are happening. Now, in this case, if all that Jesus had wanted to do was to heal that man, and in addition, avoid escalating the tension with the Pharisees, which was in the air, how could he have done it to heal this man without stirring the pot?
He could have done it not on the Sabbath. He could have done it quietly. I mean, there are all sorts of ways of dealing with that and not bringing the attention to it.
Okay. Which leaves us with the question of why he didn't do it that way. So what do you think? Why didn't he?
He wanted them to put something other than the law about the Sabbath up at the front.
Okay. Sure.
He wanted to provoke a confrontation.
With whom?
With the Pharisees and the Herodians.
And why? And why?
To indicate to them that he was not of them. Okay. And that they were not of God.
Okay. So he set up, as very clearly staged a kind of a demonstration in that room where he got this man to come up front. And he looks around, and Jesus asks his question, his own question. He changes the agenda, if you will. And he asks, is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do harm, to save life or to kill? And it says they were silent. But, and then what did Jesus do? What's the next word about him? He looked at them with how?
With anger.
Anger. How do you like an angry Jesus? Are we familiar with that Jesus? Not too much, huh? Is this a peacemaker at work? Was it only anger?
Grief.
And where was that coming from? What was his grief about?
Because they couldn't see. It's that they go together, the anger and the disappointment, grief.
Mm-hmm.
That this,
yeah.
They were in the synagogue and worshiping something that was not God.
Mm-hmm.
But he grieved over that.
Okay, he grieved over that.
But he grieved over the hardness of their
heart. The hardness of their heart.
Their unwillingness to pay attention to their own sense of what should be done. You know,
yeah.
It's self-evident, that issue of not attending to that.
Okay. That not paying attention, you said, and in the text we read earlier, Jesus, he said, do you have eyes and not see, and ears and you don't hear? So much of life and discipleship has to do with paying attention to what's in front of us, to seeing what is there to be seen, and not to harden ourselves from the truth that's available to us. So in this situation, Jesus is doing, he's concerned to do more than to heal one man. He is concerned to point out what the power struggle is and name the principal characters in this place. Who is it that's holding this man back from healing, and why? What's going on here? And so he draws out the fact that the Pharisees are trying to protect their interpretation of the law. And just how do you feel about the Pharisees' motivations? Can we say anything good about the Pharisees?
They were continuing to perpetuate their own position and their own level of control and power.
Okay, that's not saying much good about them. I think this is true.
They might have thought they were saving the church.
Huh?
Saving the Jewish, you know, culture and religion.
Isn't that true? That's the question we asked earlier. With their program, they had a program for saving the community.
I think they really felt they were being faithful in what they were doing. They really believed that.
Right. Did we ever see anything like that in our world or our church? and then the question becomes, in that kind of situation, you know, can we talk about being wrong and being right? And it's not all the same thing. And how do we work at that?
My guess, too, is like any other group, there were probably some very virtuous people in the Pharisees. Mm-hmm. And some pretty power-hungry scoundrels in there, too. I mean, it's easy to look at them as a group. But in most cases, you know, human power groups have a very mixed population within them. Some of them fall into the category of the person that the gentleman just mentioned, kind of earnest people really feeling that they were doing what was good for the community. And then other people that, you know, were less virtuous and more self-serving. So it's always tricky to categorize any one human group.
Well, sure it is. And it's tricky to discern between competing agendas for helping the community, you know, different views of how to do it.
Is it possible? I mean, we focus so much on Jesus' teaching and their inability to recognize the truth, but is it possible that they were contending with all kinds of prophets and people who were coming along trying to change what the teaching was of the Pharisees? And so to weed out the chaff from the wheat was not always self-evident.
Oh, very true. Very true.
No. Just some numbers to give you an idea about the Pharisees. There were 6 million Jews at the time of the Roman Empire, which amounted to roughly 10% of the people that they had overseer of. And those 6 million Jews were expected every year, regardless of where they lived, and they lived all over in Egypt and various locations, Greece, Rome, they were expected to give 10% of their wealth to the Pharisees. Pharisees were sitting on literally a fortune, and they didn't use it to help the poor.
Okay, thank you. Helps us to get into that socioeconomic, religious situation.
I wonder if there's a cultural component as well, if they were trying to, I mean, here's the Jewish state no longer exists. They're trying to preserve in their minds the distinctness of their culture and their faith in this vast sea of the Roman Empire, and choosing a very legalistic way to go about it, a very narrow way to go about it, but that's the way, the sort of the middle way that they perceived to be distinct and yet not conflict with that broader culture in a real overt way.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. How does Jesus look in this mix? Does he look recalcitrant or radical? works at it? I think that's a serious question we need to ask ourselves. We who call ourselves his followers. Now, at the end of the story, this very interesting thing happens. The Pharisees went out and immediately conspired with the Herodians against him how to destroy him. So you have homicidal intent here, but it's in this, what, sort of curious coming together. Remember what we said about these two groups as leaders. They had quite different attitudes toward Rome, for example, I think, or the Roman power or influence. The Pharisees were trying to keep the community poor, pure, and separate. I would think the Herodians kind of maximized compromise. Let's make it work. And here they're coming together, focused on Jesus. Okay. Let's follow Jesus further in his journey. On the pages I hand out, we have this Luke 9 story, middle of the page, it says, Luke 9:51. When the days drew near for him to be taken up, he set his face to go to Jerusalem. And that's the key thing I want to lift out of this text, that, that for our purposes, there's a lot more here, but this business of setting his face to go to Jerusalem, it speaks of his intent to, his very purposeful decision to move toward Jerusalem. And I'll just suggest that sometime you look at this text, we won't stop for it this morning, but how the Samaritans don't receive him. They're inhospitable. And the disciples say, shall we call down fire from heaven? Shall we destroy these people, these threatening, inhospitable people? And Jesus rebukes them. He says, no. And if you look at the bottom of the page, that 2 Kings chapter 1 story, that's the story of where Elijah wiped out the enemy with fire from heaven, 50 at a throw. So that was an antecedent to this question about calling down fire from heaven. And the point I just want to draw here is Jesus did not use the Elijah method, and he rejected it. You have a difference there then between what you can find in the Hebrew scriptures and some of that tradition of destroying the enemy and what Jesus did. Jesus said, no, that's not the way we're doing it. So Jesus heads toward Jerusalem. Take a moment with me to talk about what Jerusalem was symbolically and really in terms of the fate of the people of Israel, the whole community. What did Jerusalem represent in terms of power, politics, religion? What was the importance of the place? In terms of power and politics and religion.
Well, it was the center of their world.
Okay. It was where it was all concentrated. And in the early ministry of Jesus, he's out in the countryside and in small towns. But as his ministry progresses and his, if you will, his focus on the oppressive powers that are holding these people down, he moves toward Jerusalem physically, toward that place of concentrated power. At this point, I'd like to read a bit about Jerusalem and the priesthood, and about the Herodians, or Herod, from Jack Nelson Palmyre's book, Jesus Against Christianity. And this is in the context now of Jesus cleansing the temple. You know that story? Jesus, I would call it cleansing the temple. That's maybe a mild way to put it. He really disturbed the scene there. Although, you know, maybe he didn't actually accomplish that much cleansing of the whole system. It was more of a symbolic act. But what was the symbolism of that act? One of the questions, as I read at some length from Jack, I want you to think about how do the religious powers and the political powers come together or interrelate, especially in relation to the temple. This is really basic historical and cultural information without which I think we simply are not going to grasp the significance of something like temple cleansing. And so, as I've said before, when I read from other writers, I do that without apology because I think we are all very indebted to other people, and I don't mind introducing you to Jack Nelson Pallmeyer's book, Jesus Against Christianity. Remind me, last night, Daniel Wee talked about God against the church or Christians. Well, I think we have Jesus against Christianity. Mark's reference to Herodians plotting to murder Jesus pointed to the role of client kings in the domination system. That's a phrase you may or may not be familiar with, domination system, system that rules by coercion, power, homicidal violence. His inclusion of Pharisees calls attention to Jewish religious groups in the first century Palestine. In this chapter, he says, we examine Jesus' conflict with temple authorities and religious functionaries who played important roles in this oppressive system. First section is Rome and temple. The domination system in Palestine produced opulence and power for a tiny elite, and poverty and despair for the overwhelming majority. Elite consumption was made possible by wealth drained from the countryside through ruthless exploitation. The system was controlled by Imperial Rome, backed by oppressive military power, and guided by religious authority centered in the Jewish temple. The word religious is placed in quotes here because there was no separation between religion and politics, and the temple was an institution of enormous political, economic, and religious consequences in first century Palestine. The key players in the domination system were arrogant, powerful, and cruel, not because they were inherently evil, but because oppression was a systemic necessity. At the pinnacle stood the Roman Empire, and under it, those who ruled on its behalf. Rome's power touched all aspects of life. Its arrogance included religious claims concerning the blessing of the gods and the divinity of the emperor. And he talked about the religious claims. Its brutality featured massacres and crucifixions of potential and actual rebels as part of a strategy for psychological warfare, intimidation, and control. Its propaganda and ideological persuasion included promotion of the emperor cult and Rome's gospel, good news, that of peace. They actually had a language, a word in the Roman language, and they used the word that was gospel for the news of victories and war. And the word that our text and Jesus used, gospel, is the same word Romans used for victory and war. Its support for Greek cultural activities, including athletic games, diverted attention from fundamental problems, much like professional sports do today. Oh, should we talk about that? Its power over client kings, governors, and high priests assured political control. For all the wonders of Roman power, the system could not function smoothly in Palestine without cooperation and co-optation of the Jewish temple. This meant that while Roman governors and client kings exercised ultimate authority over the temple, they could not ignore Jewish priestly leaders. This dilemma meant Jewish elites were given a stake in the system. The priests, who benefited from collaborative rule, influenced society directly and through retainers, such as the scribes and Pharisees. Recent archaeological evidence demonstrates that collaborative rule brought significant benefits to high priestly groups. And he then quotes a book by Horsley and Silberman, The Message and the Kingdom. And I'll read just a bit of this quote on how this system worked with the priests working together with Rome. Ever since the vast expansion of the temple structures and institutions, these high priestly families and families of priestly officers in charge of temple's treasury, workshops, storehouses, and supply facilities, they had all amassed considerable fortunes, passing down their particular responsibilities and privileges and wealth from fathers to sons. So this temple priesthood, the stuff was passed down, inherited, generation to generation. Let me see, I just want to add just a couple more lines here. Nelson Pallmeyer says, high priestly rulers stood between the people and Rome while claiming to stand between the people and God. Think about that. The priestly rulers stood really between the people and Rome while claiming to stand between the people and God. And finally, this paragraph from Horsley and Silberman again. The temple was clearly the basis of an economic system in which the agricultural producers supported the priests, particularly the priestly aristocracy, who administered the system and were its chief beneficiaries. Besides its religious basis, the tithes and offerings ostensibly being given to God, the system had the political backing of the empire. Caesar, having decreed shortly after Rome took control of Palestine, that the tithes would be brought to the high priests. So the temple stood at the center of power in Jewish society in every respect. Now, if you have your Bible, let's look now at Mark 11. Here in Mark 11, Jesus is arriving in Jerusalem. He's been focused on getting to Jerusalem, and he's arriving. Mark 11, verse 11. Okay, this is after what's called the triumphal entry. You know, on every Palm Sunday in our churches, we have the wave of palms, and so forth. Okay, let's read Mark's account of what's going on here. Verse 11. Then he entered Jerusalem and went into the temple. And when he had looked around at everything, as it was already late, he went out to Bethany with the 12. On the following day, when they came from Bethany, he was hungry. Now, just to note, as a strategy of writing or as a literary technique, Mark here makes the effort to tell us that Jesus went, the first thing he did when he entered the city is he went and he looked over the temple. So our mind, as a reader, has been taken to the temple. And there's some interest here in the temple. Then he leaves, and on the following day, he was hungry. Seeing in the distance a fig tree in leaf, he went to see whether perhaps he would find anything on it. When he came to it, he found nothing but leaves, for it was not the season for figs. He said to it, "May no one ever eat fruit from you again." And his disciples heard it. This is the cursing of the fig tree. How do you like that story? I see a few heads shaking. No. Well, let's work that interpretation of that story. Okay, so far what you have, he sees the tree, and he found nothing but leaves, for it was not the season for figs. Now, Jesus doesn't look very bright for cursing a tree for not having fruit that wasn't supposed to have fruit on, right? Okay? Well, that could well be a signal that this isn't just about a tree without fruit. We're talking some kind of symbolism here. There's something bigger going on. Let's look for what the bigger thing is. Let's not get hung up on this, the literal specifics of this little tree. What did a fig tree often represent in Jewish lore and history, in Hebrew thought? The prophets sometimes spoke of the fig tree as a symbol of who or what?
Life.
Life.
Blessings.
Blessings. But they got a little more specific sometimes. I'm sorry, I don't know if that reference is right. They would talk of Israel itself, the people of God, as a tree and even as a fig tree. And it was not an unfamiliar, it was a familiar image for Israel, God's people, fig tree. So he curses his tree and his disciples heard it. Then, now what happens next? They came to Jerusalem and he entered the temple, began to drive out those who were selling and those who were buying in the temple. And he overturned tables of money changers, seats of those who sold doves. He said, my house shall be called a house of prayer for all the nations. This is an inclusive. This would be an inclusive house of prayer. But you made a den of robbers. And when chief priests and scribes heard it, they kept looking for a way to kill him. This is heavy-duty stuff. For they were afraid of him, because the whole crowd was spellbound by his teaching. And when evening came, Jesus' disciples went out of the city. In the morning, as they passed by, they saw a fig tree withered away to its roots. Then Peter remembered and said to him, Rabbi, look, the fig tree that you cursed has withered. Jesus answered them, have faith in God. Truly I tell you, if you say to this mountain, be taken up and thrown into the sea, and if you do not doubt in your heart, but believe that what you say will come to pass, it will be done for you. So I tell you, whatever you ask for in prayer, believe what you have received it, and it will be yours.
I've written on the board here about the temple. The Temple Mount. Does Temple Mount ring any bells? I mean, do you think of that? You've read about the temple, and you have the Old Testament stories, you have a sense that it built in a high place. And it was also called Mount Zion. Remember? Mount Zion. What if whenever Jesus said, if you pray in faith and say to this mountain, be cast in the sea, it'll be done for you. What if he wasn't talking about mountains in general? He wasn't talking about Bonanza Peak or something. He was talking about Temple Mount. This oppressive structure that was corrupted. He says, you can actually have the faith to see that happen. I present that as a possibility. And I also ask you now to think about try to relate this to the fig tree story. Can you make any connection? Yeah.
Well, it kind of seems like he is cursing the current Israeli state as it perpetuated to the time and place where he is, like from maybe the like better past that it had. And so by saying like, if you like save them out to turn them and see, they say if you try, you can make the changes that you can put forth. Like it's not beyond your...
Not impossible.
Yeah.
Chad Myers has, in his commentary on Mark, have any of you ever seen his Chad Myers? Are you familiar with that? It's a pretty radical commentary on Mark's gospel. Really worth its weight in something valuable. Chad talks about this whole scenario and about prayer. And prayer doesn't show up very often in Mark's gospel as a word, as an idea. But here's a sentence from Chad. To pray, and that's what Jesus says here. Jesus says, whatever you ask for in prayer, believe that you have received it and will be yours. Chad says, to pray is to learn to believe in a transformation of self and world, which seems empirically impossible. As in moving mountains. So to pray is to learn to believe in the transformation of self and the world. So what kind of a transformation? The man here has spoken about the change that could happen in the Jewish structure. Well, maybe we should talk a little more about the cursing of the tree. Now, does that see the cursing of the tree is in two parts, and in the, it's a sandwich kind of thing. One day, and then you have this temple thing, cleansing, if you will, and then you have the next day looking at the tree and saying, "Oh, it's disappeared." You don't know. Yeah.
It seems like the tree could be like indicative of the temple that he cleared out, because he saw it the first day and didn't have any of the fruits of the tree, just had like the tree structure. Mm-hmm. So then he went through and cleansed the temple, got rid of all of the structure that it had, and the temple itself didn't have any fruits. So the next day when he went back, it didn't even have the structure.
Yeah. Yeah.
Notice it said he was hungry and looked at the tree, and mm-hmm. there was no fruit.
Okay. We're going to say more about that. What kind of hunger? What are we talking about?
Well, I'm assuming that's symbolic also. And it may even be symbolic of not just his hunger, but the people whom he came to represent, the hunger of all the people. And they weren't being fed from the tree.
You're right. This tree is not bearing fruit. This temple establishment is not bearing fruit.
Well, and then can you also... Was there an implication that even if it were the season for fruit, the fruit that it would bear would not be proper fruit, or it would be a fruit that was not to be eaten by the people?
Mm-hmm. Not nourishing.
Mm-hmm. Possible. Yeah.
A question that has troubled me along this line here. Did Jesus come here on earth believing that he had a chance to change the Israelites, or did he always know that it would be a new covenant and it would be a break?
Mm-hmm. Thoughts on that?
Did he even want to just change the Israelites? I mean, he came to all people, so he was breaking the boundaries anyway.
I think it's really kind of a puzzle to know if Jesus knew all of his mission. Some hints in the Gospels imply that maybe he didn't.
Okay.
Did he, or was it revealed gradually? Or?
Well, what I would say to that is that in any case, I don't believe Jesus came expecting to do what needed to be done for or instead of us, so much as he came to show us what a complete, whole human being and a fulfilled humanity would look like, and what the reign of God would look like. And so I think he was revealing a way to be in the world by which not only Israel would be transformed, but the whole human enterprise moves toward this vision. And I don't think Jesus is the only one through whom any of that vision has come. It's come through lots of people, but it's hardly come better than him. At least those of us who call ourselves Christians ought to take his piece of the vision pretty seriously.
In reference to your comment on prayer, is it possible to say in this text that through him... and through prayer, the impossible can be possible. We can become by his presence. So it's both, really.
Oh, sure it is.
Yeah.
Sure it is.
Especially if we pray with our feet.
Well, yeah. Well, you know, I don't know. I said yesterday, I don't want to bore people saying the same thing, but I said a peace church is a church which does not imagine that it can accomplish with its prayers what it refuses to embody in its politics. Our feet have to be at the same place our prayers are, or neither means much. Much at all. Okay, well, we've got to the point of wrapping this up. Before we quit, just want to say, I know some of you have been going to Gary Cole's sessions too, and I hope you maybe can find a tape where he's suggesting there that, you know, that one of the purposes of the tapes is that you can pick up other sessions. See what went into that. Are there questions or thoughts about that you have at this point, now how this might relate to Every Church of Peace Church or your enterprise when you go back home, or anything? I just welcome summing up observations, questions. I suggested that what this process that we engage in here is something that can be multiplied in small groups, and one of the missions of a person who gets engaged with Every Church of Peace Church and finds a partner and finds a small group, one of their missions is to work at this revisiting Jesus and at biblical interpretation and at looking at how Jesus lived and taught, filling in some of that comma in the Apostles' Creed between Jesus' birth and his death. Yeah. Okay, well, thanks for being here. I hope we can continue the conversation in a variety of ways. And I remind again of the internet website. And sometime after you're back home, look up ECAP.